We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. At the controls this hour, Jason Croft, and hour number one, it was Kyle Mabry. Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, is home to one of the richest gas deposits in the entire world. It's the Marcellus Shale, and it is thought that it could contain as much as a 25-year supply of natural gas. Certainly for the people who own the land there, there is the potential to make money. And they are not wealthy people. But the worry of some there and other parts around the country is that what's involved with exploring for and extracting this resource could really be devastating for the local environment. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the situation, talk a little bit about this process called fracking, and about the battle to drill the Marcellus Shale. And our guest is journalist Seamus McGraw. He has written about this in a newly published book that he titles The End of Country, and it's published by Random House. And it is a rather personal story, as we will explain. His mom was one of the first people to be approached by a gas company wanting to drill for gas on her land. Seamus McGraw is a writer full-time. His work has been published in a number of places, Playboy, Reader's Digest, Radar, Spin, The Forward. He's received the Freedom of Information Award from the Associated Press Managing Editors, as well as honors from the Casey Foundation and the Society for Professional Journalists. And right now he's working on a documentary about his experiences, his family's experiences with the Marcellus Shale, and he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, as always, questions from listeners are welcome. We just hope people can be brief and on target, and if you can do that, your call is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. If you would like to send an email, you can do that too. And that is will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And Mr. McGraw, hello.
Hey, how are you, David?
I'm good, thanks.
Call me Seamus.
All right, Seamus, I appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
And for you, this certainly is a very personal story. The book is it's a journalistic exercise, but it's also a kind of a memoir, and this is really about the place where you grew up.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's about ground zero for my family, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and it did start when someone approached your mom about buying the rights to drill there on the land where she was living, and she wasn't really quite so sure, so she picked up the telephone and called you. Mm-hmm. And when you first started talking to her about this, I gathered that you didn't know anything about any of this.
I didn't have a clue, David. As I say in the book, at that time I couldn't have told you the difference between the Marcellus Shale and Cassius Clay. I knew nothing about it. It wasn't my background. It wasn't my expertise, and I was as confused and amazed as everybody else.
Well, what was the main sources of confusion and amazement? Was it the fact that that people now were rolling up to houses like your mom's and knocking on the front door and offering to deposit a large basket of cash on their front porch?
Well, bear in mind that at first they weren't really talking about large baskets of cash. Mm-hmm. They were talking about, when this first started, you were talking about $10, $15, $20 an acre, $25 an acre to lease the land rights, the mineral rights. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about people getting a few hundred bucks, maybe $2,500 for the right to give these guys the right to come up and basically prospect. Nobody really knew what was unfolding. But while this was happening up there, quite by accident, almost, the Marcellus, which is now judged to be the third, some say the second richest deposit of natural gas in the world, holding 500 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, had for the first time really been tapped into in a way that made it developable. And that was because of the advance of certain technologies. But at that stage of the game, nobody knew anything about it. And what little remained of oil and gas exploration in Pennsylvania was something, it was focused largely in the western part of the state. We're in the Northeast. But it was something that was such an also-ran in terms of the economy that I'll give you an example. One of the guys on the Fish and Game Commission also served as a landman in his spare time, and nobody thought anything more of that in those days than if the guy had been working at Walmart on weekends. It just wasn't a big deal because there wasn't anything there. But as they first showed up, it was because this vast resource had been discovered, and people were still just kind of starting to come to terms with it.
And was it also a case that they weren't quite sure what was involved in exploiting the resource, or at that point they really knew essentially what the process was going to have to be to get it out of the ground?
When you say they, do you mean the gas?
I mean the gas companies. Yeah.
The gas guys knew to a very great extent what it was that would be required, because this was we're talking about hydraulic fracturing. We're talking about horizontal drilling. And this was hydraulic fracturing, of course, has been around for 60 years. But the type of hydraulic fracturing that was going on here was slick water hydraulic fracturing, had been developed and evolved in really only the last couple of years. And it had been employed in places like the Barnett Shale in Texas. It was beginning to be employed in places like the Haynesville Shale, the Fayetteville Shale. And these had been a game changer for the country. Why is because as little as 10 years ago, we were sort of convinced as a nation that we were in danger of running out of natural gas. And this technology allowed them to exploit these shales, these deeply buried rocks, and pull the gas out of them in a way that had never been possible before. And it, within a matter of a couple of years, completely changed natural gas's role in our energy picture, but also changed our energy picture in general.
Yeah. This is something that has now gotten coverage, and people maybe now will be familiar with the term, or at least they've heard the term fracking, which is the short for hydraulic fracturing, and maybe have associated this with real concerns about the environmental impact for people who live right around the places where they're doing this. And the big concern seems to be the potential for contamination of groundwater, either by the gas itself or by the chemicals that are used in the process. Can you just in brief talk about, well, what is a hydraulic fracturing?
Hydraulic fracturing is the most known as fracking. Is probably, from a language standpoint, the worst public relations debacle that the energy industry has received in the last couple of years, if you separate out the BP spill in the Gulf. And the reason is that it's, as a word, it's come to represent all the ills that can occur from natural gas drilling. In short, what the process is they drill down, in the Marcellus, for example, they drill down about 7,000 feet to where the shale is the thickest. They then drill out, in some cases, as much as a mile and a half. And they then take a chemically treated water. It's 98% water, the industry will tell you, about 2% chemicals that include, as the industry is fond of saying, a lot of the same things you have under your kitchen sink. And they'll blast that down to somewhere between 3 and 7 million gallons of that at pressures often exceeding 9,000 pounds per square inch to shatter the rock. And about somewhere between 30 and 50% of that water will return to the surface. The concerns about fracking, David, are multiple. One is, where does the water come from? Now, in Pennsylvania, we're fortunate in that we have more groundwater, more surface water than virtually any other state, well, than any other state except for Alaska. And we have agencies that regulate the use of that fairly fairly closely. Disposing of the wastewater is a somewhat more contentious problem, a significantly more contentious problem, because when that water comes back, it's not just bringing back the chemicals that are used in the fracking fluid itself, but it's also bringing back produced water, the highly salty, in some cases mildly radioactive water that's actually contained in the shale itself. And that has to be disposed of. We have some plants, one coming up in Williamsport, for example, that do it by basically distilling the water. And somewhere between 70 and 90% of the wells drilled in Pennsylvania now use recycled water. Interestingly enough, they're also using acid mine water in that mix. It still, at the end of the process, needs to be disposed of. And there, of course, is one of the challenges we have in Pennsylvania, trying to find a place to get rid of that stuff. Some of it now is being, a significant amount of it now is being shipped into Ohio, where they have deep wells that they inject this in, which is the EPA's preferred method. Just one point I want to make, though, is that the dangers posed by fracking, per se, really, so far, have largely been issues of surface spills, and that's a real concern. In terms of groundwater contamination from below, what you've run into in Pennsylvania, in the area around where my farm is, has been methane contamination. And that's been coming from higher levels of buried gas that really have not been, at least according to the DEP, properly isolated when this drilling has taken place. And so you got a real challenge there. And it's separate from the fracking issue, but it's a serious challenge and one we're still grappling with in the state.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the kind of thing that, again, people have heard about, concerns on for the health and safety of people who live around the places where this goes on, and I'm sure that people may indeed have seen these videos of people turning on the tap in their kitchen and then lighting it on fire.
I need to take that one on, David.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
One of the issues there is that particular very famous clip now. The industry and state regulators in that state have both said that is it's an existing deposit of natural gas. The question really comes down to, is there anything in these cases where you see this sort of thing where the drillers erred? And I think as often as not, you'll find that it's a mechanical problem. It's a mechanical problem in isolating those wells. But yes, it is a very contentious issue.
Well, that then the ultimate question is, and I'm sure depending on who you ask, you'll get a different answer, is this something that, if done correctly, can make it possible to use this energy resource and not damage the environment? Or, as I'm sure some people argue, the other pole, the extreme pole, is for those people that said that nothing good can come of this, that it's just another example of despoiling the environment to satisfy our unreasonably voracious appetite for energy.
David, I think you've hit the essence of the debate, and I think you've hit the essence of what my book is. We have to look, obviously, at the environmental risks posed by drilling this stuff. And there are serious, real risks. But we can't view it in a vacuum, David. We can't view it in a vacuum. We live in a country right now that depends for half of its electricity, on the dirtiest, most dangerous, most environmentally disruptive fuel there is. We rely for another significant part of our energy on a fuel that requires us to take dramatic risks in places where we don't have the technology to manage those risks, like the Gulf of Mexico in the pursuit of oil, that requires us to send our young men and women overseas in order to guarantee these resources. I tell the story in the book about how about the time the first landman showed up in the area around my farm, 54 kids from the three-county area up there, from Susquehanna, Bradford, and Wayne counties, shipped off to Iraq with the National Guard. Now, there's been a long history in rural America and in that area in particular of real devotion to the idea of military service. But the truth is, over the last 60 years, a series of bad farm policies have held the price of milk at basically the same level. Whereas the one thing that is required to produce that in every aspect of it, from running your tractor to the fertilizer for your field to the seed corn to everything, has continued to increase. Obviously, I'm talking about oil at a staggering rate. The result is that farms have failed up there at an alarming rate. When I was a kid, you could drive the roughly 6 miles from Route 6 to my farm and pass 18 farms. Today, there are two. And when those farms went down, so did everything that supported those farms. And when those went down, so did the opportunities for kids to do anything other than leave town, just get by, and maybe supplement their income by joining the military. About the time that the first significant well came through in that area, 8 of those kids were killed in a roadside bomb in Fallujah. I was talking to Aubrey McClendon, who is the head of Chesapeake Energy. And this Aubrey is no liberal by any stretch of the imagination. He even was one of the supporters of the Swift Boat Veterans of Truth. I doubt that I agree with this guy on more than 3 things in the world. I do agree with him on this. He said, "I won't tell you that was a war for oil, but I will tell you that if there wasn't oil, there wouldn't have been a war there." And so the point that I'm making is that when we calculate out the risks of drilling for natural gas, and they are profound and real, we need to put them into the overall balance. Now, you talked about the extreme positions on either side. And there are. There are people who say, no drilling, no way, no how, and we'll wait for, you know, we'll wait for the development of alternative forms of energy that are less disruptive. Well, in the state of Pennsylvania right now, we have 16 wind farms sprawling across miles of our mountaintops. They account for 11% of the electricity that we produce. When we're talking about this, we need to understand that the risks and opportunities really need to be explored and haven't been because, quite frankly, in this debate in this country, rather than focus on the issue at hand, I think there's a very great tendency, and it happens in everything that we debate in this country, there is a tendency to kind of hide behind our ideological parapets and collect the information that we want. And as a result, we haven't even begun to have the real debate about this yet. And that's what I really try to get at in my book, not in terms of a polemic, but in terms of the real-life stories of the people I knew growing up.
Let me introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus for anybody who has just tuned in. He's a journalist. His name is Seamus McGraw. He grew up in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, which is the place that you will find the Marcellus Shale. That's a gas field that is estimated to hold as much as $1 trillion worth of natural gas. People have on the one hand said, well, this is an important domestic resource. We need it for our energy. People in the area have said, well, this is a way for us to make a little bit of money, and it's certainly not a place where people are rich. And on the other hand, people have said, but done wrong, the environmental consequences of trying to develop this resource could be devastating. And it's this whole picture trying to represent how people think about this and maybe how we should all be thinking about it is something that Seamus tries to do in his book, The End of Country, and it's published by Random House. It's just recently out. So questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we do also have that email if you'd like to send us a message. You can do that at will-talk@illinois.edu. And let me go here to the phones. We got our first caller in Piatone, line four. Hello.
Good morning, David and guest. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Great. You know what? Can't even speak today. The environmental issue is always a big topic. And I think sometimes it gets a little bit thrown out the window and carried on more than it needs to be. I do agree that we need to start, whatever it is for energy, we need to start doing our own energy and not buying it from somebody else. In other words, America can do this on its own instead of relying on other people. Secondly, the problem and the biggest issue I see, the biggest problem I see, what you're talking about environmentally, I do believe that it is critical that whatever company goes out there and does this process needs to be held liable for any kind of infractions that may occur in the future. And, you know, the EPA right now, I think, doesn't have enough people on the ground to oversee all aspects of, you know, whether it be from what you're talking about to, you know, everything else under the sun. The problem I think most Americans have is that, you know, nobody wants it in their backyard, but they're saying we need to take care of ourselves. You know, well, you know, in case in hand, I'm talking about nuclear waste. What do you do with it? Everybody wants, you know, nuclear power, but nobody wants to get rid of the waste. Nobody wants it in their backyard. So somewhere along the line, I think we got to cave in, and there's got to be a 50-50. Some of us got to give and take. Now, I listened to you discuss this, and I've read somewhat on it, and it's a good idea. But, again, America's going to have to deal with two or three or four different forms of energy in the future in order to make itself, viable. Otherwise, if we rely on gas and oil and, you know, solar and wind as a single entity, it's not going to happen. I'm just curious how you think about it. And what you'd say. I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. And in particular, I'm interested in having you look at this question of regulation and oversight and whether, in fact, you think and people there think that the government's doing what it's supposed to be doing.
I think that's a phenomenal question. But I think the caller hits two points. And one is government responsibility and the other is individual responsibility. And I'll take them in turn. We do not. Not in the state of Pennsylvania, not in the state of Texas, not in the state of Wyoming, and not in the United States do we have the regulators or the regulations that we need to adequately govern this. We don't. There will never be enough cops on the beat to make sure that this cannot be, that this can be done in a way that is safe. What we can do and what we haven't done is to establish through policy and through the use of taxation, quite frankly, a series of incentives to make these guys do it themselves. there is a tendency to either look at gas drillers and oil drillers, for that matter, as sort of rugged individualists out there carving out a future on America's energy frontier, or conversely, as mustache-twirling villains. They're neither. They're corporations, and corporations are motivated by profit. And what we need to do on the state level and on the national level is set up a level where these guys are adequately taxed and where they are able to get rebates for those taxes for taking the additional steps, not just to minimize the impact at the wellhead, which is significant, but all the way through the system. For all the benefits of natural gas, it burns 30% cleaner than oil, it burns 50% cleaner than coal. Methane itself is still a significant greenhouse gas, and we're leaking a lot of it into the environment. We are not using it as efficiently as we can just in terms of the ways we use it now, and we are not expanding its use in a way that could have certain economic benefits and environmental benefits. Because, quite frankly, it's been 60 years since we've had an energy plan. We still don't have one. And we're still debating what role natural gas will play in whatever energy policy we get. It's 40 years after Hubbard's Peak. It's 30 years after Ronald Reagan ripped the solar panels off the White House, and we still don't have an energy policy. In the meantime, the responsibility for policing this, and this is what I really go into in the book with stories of people who really did do exactly what I'm talking about here, the responsibility for making sure that this is done right falls on the people on whom it's always fallen. It falls on the people on the ground. And this becomes a test of their character and, quite frankly, all of our character as to whether or not we can be responsible and vigilant. Now, I've known these people all my life. I have a great deal of faith in the people up there. I'm not sure that that faith extends to the people all the way across the country. And I'm, quite frankly, as you find in the book, not entirely sure that I'm sure it extends to me.
Well, we're at a point we just need to take a quick break. Seamus McGraw is our guest. He's a journalist, and we're talking about his book, The End of Country. And it's published by Random House. It's just out. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, neuroscientist Dean Buonomano. He says our brains are adapted for a prehistoric world very different from our own, and its quirks affect the way we think and behave. And Brian Chen of Wired.com considers the impact of smartphones and living in a world where we're always on. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. We're here for you throughout the week with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Hunter Lovins, co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. And we'll talk about a book that she has authored. The title is Climate Capitalism, Capitalism in the Age of Climate Change. And she and the other people there at Rocky Mountain have for a long time been making this argument that says a sound and environmentally friendly energy policy does not have to be bad for the economy. In fact, it can be good for the economy. That's the kind of argument that they make. That's hour one. Then tomorrow also, in the second hour, we'll talk about Afghanistan. And our guest there will be Ambassador Peter Thompson. He is ambassador in residence at the University of Nebraska, held ambassador rank during the Bush administration. We will be talking about his book, The Wars of Afghanistan, Messianic Terrorism, Tribal Conflicts, and the Failures of the Great Powers. If you'd like to find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead or listen to past programs, you can do all of that by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. And in this part of Focus, we're talking with journalist Seamus McGraw. His book is The End of Country. It's published by Random House, and it is in part about a place that he grew up in Pennsylvania, which is home to the Marcellus Shale. It's a gas field that is thought to have maybe as much as a trillion dollars worth of natural gas, and it is the subject of a lot of controversy about the environmental impact of developing that resource. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I have a couple callers we'll get to, but I wanted to do an email here that goes back to the question of water use. From someone who said that they're interested not so much in the issue of pollution from the water that has been used, but they're interested in, at the front end, the water that's being consumed in the process, where it comes from, and what's the potential impact for using millions of gallons of water on the water resource for the area. That would be the resource that people would obviously rely on for drinking water and so forth. And it's something she says she understands the focus on polluted water, but nobody seems to address the issue of overall of water consumption.
Well, actually, that was one of the first issues that really was addressed. It was addressed by the Susquehanna River Basin Authority. It's still in contention with the Delaware River Authority. In Pennsylvania, as I mentioned, we have been blessed with a staggering amount of surface water. Some of the other states where drilling is taking place, this is a significantly more vexing issue. Texas being one where actually because of recent droughts there's actually been some cutting back on drilling. But the issue is how much of that water is actually used. And early on, the river authorities got involved in permitting the withdrawal of water. Now, that's not to say that there still hasn't been some questionable withdrawal from headwaters, but that's largely been regulated by the state. So the water is pulled out by these is regulated by these multi-state agencies. The amount of water that would be used, even if the entire Marcellus would be developed, would be really a fraction of what's used by, frankly, our coal and nuclear plants at this point. It's about the equivalent of what we use in one of our cities in Pennsylvania. But that's a much more vexing problem in states that have been less blessed. One of the things that is helping somewhat, but not as much as the industry would claim, is this idea of recycling, of reusing the water that comes back from the wells and also drawing water from other sources, like the heavily polluted water from 150 years of coal mining in Pennsylvania, the acid mine drainage. That reduces the consumption somewhat, but frankly, a whole lot of fresh water still has to be drawn to dilute that stuff to the point where it can be used in the equipment. So it's a concern. It's a concern that's being managed in Pennsylvania. I expect that it's the kind of concern that would be managed in the Appalachian play. I'd be much more concerned about that, as I say, in the more arid West.
All right. Well, let's get back with some people who are on the phone. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I would like to know if David and your guest are aware that a bill was introduced in the Illinois legislature this past year to regulate something about fracking. Are you aware of that?
I am not. I would expect that he probably wouldn't be, since he's doesn't
there
live
there. There are a number of regulations that are moving through kind of across the country. You have some places that are banning the practice outright, New Jersey being one of them, which I find fascinating because New Jersey doesn't have any prospective shale. What you have found is that there's one of the big issues is what goes into that fracking fluid, what are the chemicals that are used, and there has been a tremendously welcome and aggressive move across the country to force the industries to disclose. Wyoming has a law, Pennsylvania has a law, Texas has recently enacted one. And that's a critical issue because to a very great extent, not all, but some of the elements of the chemicals, which again account for about 2% of the water itself, have been kind of protected as a trade secret, and
yeah.
it's essential that that not be the case?
Well, here in Illinois, the bill was introduced. It got a little bit. It progressed somewhat, and then it kind of disappeared. And it was a law just that the fracking operators would have to disclose the chemicals, which seems to me such a token. It's a step, but it's a token according to what really needs to happen with those chemicals. I'd also just like to tell you that our, right here in Urbana and Champaign, our senator and our state representative are both opposed to, are both advocating to be aware of what's going on with fracking and to limit, to know what's in those chemicals. But
I don't think there's any.
We can't find other ways to crack, break the shale without using carcinogens.
Well, you will find that some of the companies, I point to Range, have been trying to do just that. And again, it's because companies like that recognize that it's in their financial interest to do that. It is, I think, essential, not just as a matter of basic fairness, but as a matter of public policy.
How about ethics?
I would agree with you, but the point, as I made before, is companies are neither moral nor immoral. They're amoral, and you're much more likely to get them to respond to economic circumstances than you are to appeals to ethics.
Right. I know.
And so, you know, it may be ethical, but I think in terms of getting them to do what we need them to do, I think that's almost irrelevant.
Well, we could debate that, but I know that this is all about the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they too, whether they want to look at this or not, they too are going to be victims of the bad results.
And you know what? You talk to them individually, and they all recognize. I don't know one of them that doesn't fly fish. Individually, they recognize it, but you're talking about institutions, and you have to deal with institutions differently than you deal with individuals.
Right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's continue and go to line number two and talk with somebody in Champaign. Right here, line two. Hello.
Is that me?
Yes.
I just recently, in the last couple of weeks, read an article in a conservative publication, I will admit, by Kathleen Hartnett White. Mm-hmm. Who was identified as having been for 6 years the chairman of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, mm-hmm. the second largest environmental regulatory agency in the world. And the subtitle of the article is Low Risk, High Reward, but the EPA is against it. It's in the June 20th issue of National Review. And I'll just mention one thing that she says. Of the fracking fluid, I'm reading it right now, of the fracking fluid, over 99.5% is water and sand.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps 0.5% is a mix, not of, quote, 596 chemicals, which she says comes from this movie called Gasland, but of just a few, such as guar gum, whatever that is, and emulsifier commonly used in ice cream.
Guar gum is what you put in ice cream, but you know what else it contains? It contains methanol. In Texas, for a very long time, it also contained diesel fuel, so you had benzene and you had toluene.
Yeah.
They are not, it's not wrong to suggest that the items that are contained in fracking fluid, by and large, are items that you have under your kitchen sink as we speak. But I'll tell you what, you're talking about 3 to 7 million gallons of fluid going down into these wells. So if you've got 50,000 gallons of methanol under your sink, you've got other issues.
Well, one more thing. She says that the monitored benzene levels attributed to natural gas drilling in the Barnett Shale, that's the one in Texas,
mm-hmm.
Are not harmful to human health. I'll just say one more thing. I would not want to bring back the fairness doctrine, but I would suggest to Mr. Inge that perhaps he might have somebody on, you know, on the other side of the issue. Thanks very much.
You know, David, I want to touch base on something like
sure.
this.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
As I've pointed out, I have, since this book came out, I have people on the pro-gas side, who tell me it's a pro-gas book. I have people on the anti-gas side who tell me it's an anti-gas book. The biggest challenge we have right now in this country is exactly what I was just talking about earlier. The idea that instead of turning around and really examining the issues that are in front of us, we have a tendency to retreat behind our ideological parapets and decide that if somebody challenges our orthodoxy, they are our adversary. That's not necessarily true. I am, personally, I have a lease on my property. And I believe very strongly in the promise that this holds. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. My family wouldn't have done it. But I also am very much aware of the risks and the need to manage these risks as best we can. We need to look at this in the whole picture. And we need to, quite frankly, stop taking sides. And this happens on both sides of the issue. This happens on both sides of the issue. I had a conversation the other day with somebody who wasn't sure whether they wanted me to read because I wasn't sufficiently anti-gas. I've had the same conversations with pro-gas people who are concerned that I'm not sufficiently pro-gas. What I am is, like everybody else in this country, desperate for a solution.
Let's take another call. This is line 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. I am calling for a couple of reasons. One is I grew up in New York State, less than an hour away from Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania. I'm very familiar with the region and also very familiar with what may be taking place across the Delaware River on the New York side, given the recent release of the environmental impact statement by New York's DEC and by statements that the moratorium on drilling on the New York side very likely will be lifted sometime in the not-too-distant future. Also, I have driven very recently through parts of Susquehanna County and through other counties in Pennsylvania and have seen some of the effects of drilling on the landscape, and they are significant. And I'd like to bring up a couple of issues. One, the previous call, or two callers ago, a woman was wondering why the composition of the fracking solution needs to be released. And one big reason that it needs to be released is that is the only way to hold the drilling companies accountable if there is a breach in an aquifer. If we don't know what the chemicals are that are going to be injected.
You do know that in Pennsylvania, for example, before they begin drilling, they need to provide that to the state of Pennsylvania, right?
In Pennsylvania,
that, right?
They do.
I'm sorry, what?
Do they need to provide that list of chemicals in Pennsylvania?
Yes, yes. They need to provide the list. Where we run into problems in Pennsylvania, and this is something that the state is working to address, is what are the precise amounts? That's where you run into the problem. I want to touch on something else for you, though, with you, though, too.
Sure.
You talk about the other side of the Delaware River. You do know there's no gas on the other side of the Delaware River, right? That's one of the reasons that Chesapeake, among others, basically vacated their leases up there. There is no prospective Marcellus gas in Sullivan County or that area, the Catskills area.
There certainly is.
No, there isn't. There really isn't. That's one of the reasons. If you look at some of the work done by Engelder and Lash, you'll find that there really isn't.
Well, there have been a lot of leases that have been signed.
Right, a couple of years back before they really knew what the sweet spots, as they put it, of the Marcellus were. On your other point, you're absolutely right that this is a full-scale and dramatic industrial endeavor. It is a full-scale and dramatic industrial endeavor. When you have one of these wells, you probably have 400 trucks coming up to drill it, carrying water, carrying people. You have pipelines cutting across the landscape. You have a tremendous amount of, and this is one of the real risks of this, you have a tremendous amount of air pollution that's associated with drilling for this. Not just the stuff that's leaking out of the wellhead, which, depending on who you talk to, is either 1 to 7% of the amount of methane that is produced, actually at some point along the process, leaches into the atmosphere. And that is one of the most devastating of the greenhouse gases. But you also have the fact that this is an entirely diesel-driven operation. About a year ago, I was out at a well in southwestern Pennsylvania talking about talking with one of the executives out there about all the economic benefits and all the environmental benefits that could come from really using natural gas. And we were out there talking, and we're driving back. And as we're driving back, he starts white-knuckling the steering wheel of his SUV, concerned that we're not going to have enough regular gas to make it back to the office. The irony was completely lost on him. But the reality is that this is one of those areas I was talking about forcing the amoral companies to kind of come to terms with the real challenge that they're facing. The environmental footprint of this is always going to be significant. It could be less significant if they actually used the natural gas to pursue the natural gas. It could be less significant if they actually did what they have in their power to do right now, capture a significant portion of that stuff that's leaching into the atmosphere. But they're not doing that, and they're not doing that because, quite frankly, they're looking at their short-term interests. What is essential is, again, for this country to develop an energy policy that kind of leads these guys to do what is in their best interest.
I need to jump in here. I want to thank the caller for the points he made. I only have a couple of minutes here. I guess what I find myself thinking a lot about the title of the book and about the fact that we talked that in this region, it's been real difficult for people to make a living in farming. And so for that reason, you wouldn't be surprised that maybe some people would find the offer of a lease and however much money it would bring to be appealing, maybe even vital.
It's more than appealing. It's vital. It's vital for a lot of these people. A lot of people signed because it was the only way to hold the farm together.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of these people signed because if they didn't sign, that 200-acre farm or that 140-acre farm was going to end up being carved up into 5 and 10-acre lots, taken out of the mix of potential farmland, and developed with all the environmental downsides that are associated with that. For some of these people, it was the only lifeline they could hope for. It's bringing with it tremendous changes. But that phrase, "the end of country," actually comes from one of my neighbors, and she wasn't just talking about the advent of natural gas. She was talking about really the 40-year decline of an entire way of life. This is part of what's been happening, really, since the 1970s.
Well, this gets me to the question that, you know, there are still people who want to farm, and there are people who are trying to find ways to live on the land, either raising animals or, you know, producing some kind of product that people want, whether it's a basic product or whether it's some kind of a boutique product. And there are people who are still trying to make a go of it, and some people who are being successful. And I wonder, is it possible in a place like this for all of these folks, where the gas companies and the people are just trying to hold on to their land and the people that are really trying to make a living and in some cases being successful, can all of these people actually coexist?
Absolutely, but it's difficult to find the common ground. And in order to find the common ground, you have to face the common challenge. You know, for the first time in 30 years, we're planning on beginning to farm again. And to a very great extent, it's because of what happened there. My neighbor across the street went out of business finally 3 years ago. Because of this, he was able to turn around and maintain the farm and has started running a cow and calf operation on it again. There are tremendous risks, and tremendous risks, quite frankly, to small farmers as a result of this. But that risk has to be balanced against the risk of doing nothing. If you want to guarantee that those farms are going to be gone, do nothing to address energy prices. Do nothing to address global warming, and you can guarantee that those farms are going to be gone.
We'll try real quick to get one more caller. I think maybe we have a caller here on our line one in Champaign. Hello. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. We spoke a minute earlier. I have one very quick question. You brought up the subject of air pollution that's associated with the drilling. You've also brought up methane contamination. What can be done, say, to convince our politicians in Washington and our state legislators to put the gas drilling companies back under the Clean Air, Clean Water Act?
They were
exempted in 2005.
I'll give you about a minute, Seamus.
I won't need a full minute for that. Write letters. Call them. That's essential. I mean, that's essential. It's the regulation. Regulation is absolutely essential of this for the adequate development of this. But again, it's more than just putting them under those acts. We need to make it in their interest to comply, because they are not motivated by good or by evil. They are motivated by the bottom line. And so we have to make it attractive to them from a fiscal point of view to do that. And the way you do that, I believe, is through tax policy.
Well, at that, we're going to have to stop. We're at the end of the time. You want to read more on the subject, you look for the book, The End of Country. It's published by Random House by our guest, Seamus McGraw. He's a full-time writer. His work has been published in a lot of different places, Reader's Digest, Radar Spin, Forward. And Seamus, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.